Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I am Rahmatullah Sheikh.
And I am Alamdi Alanion. It's Thursday, November 30th at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting to you from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hukkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. Today we'll be hearing three stories originally reported for the UBC School of Journalism's online news publication, The Thunderbird. But before that, headlines. Police uniforms and vehicles will no longer be allowed in Vancouver Pride Parade. There will be no uniformed police officers marching alongside the Pride Parade participants in Vancouver next August. Andre Arnott, Executive Director of the Vancouver Pride Society, says that the group has decided not to allow uniformed officers, police vehicles, or weapons in the annual parade. The decision comes after the LGBTQ plus community told board members of the Vancouver Pride Society they were uncomfortable seeing uniformed officers or police vehicles at the event because of historic police oppression of the LGBTQ plus community. However, plainclothes officers will be welcome to march with the City of Vancouver's parade entry.
Vancouver Council approves a 10-year housing strategy. The 10-year Vancouver housing strategy has finally taken shape after over a year of deliberations, discussions, and debates. According to Vancouver's General Manager of Planning, Jill Kelly, this housing strategy marks part of a major turning point in the city's development. The strategy aims to address a spectrum of housing issues, from combating homelessness and revitalizing low-density neighborhoods, to taming real estate speculation and increasing rental housing stock. Now, the overall strategy also includes a target of creating 72,000 new homes for renters, families, and vulnerable residents over the next 10 years. The plan comes with its own criticisms, though. Paul Kershaw, an associate professor at the University of British Columbia, wonders why the number 72,000 was the number determined to be enough units to actually rein in housing prices.
Transit use has increased among Metro Vancouver commuters. According to a census conducted last year, the number of people in Metro Vancouver using cars to commute decreased by almost 8% in the last 20 years. And during that same period, the proportion of commuters using transit in Metro Vancouver has gone up 6 percentage points. Stats Canada noted that a number of improvements to transit service since 2002 could explain the increase in use of the services. Between 2005 and 2009, the Millennium and Canada lines opened and more buses have been added to the regular routes.
Protesters interrupt an energy forum in Vancouver. A member of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation was escorted out of the annual energy forum taking place in downtown Vancouver this morning. The man, identified as William George, interrupted a speech by Kinder Morgan Canada president on the issue of Trans Mountain pipeline construction project in British Columbia. The $7.4 billion pipeline expansion project is expected to more than triple the pipeline's daily capacity and triple the number of oil tankers moving through the Georgia Strait. But the proposal is facing fierce opposition from environmentalists, First Nations, and the BC New Democratic government. All three groups are now fighting the project in federal court.
Spike in hate crimes in BC. There has been an increase in police-reported hate crime from 164 reports in 2015 to 211 in 2016. The increase was mostly targeted against East Asians, Southeast Asian, and South Asian individuals. The only other Canadian province to report an increase in the level of hate crimes is Quebec. In 2016, Canada saw a general decrease in hate crimes against Muslims and Catholics, but an increase in hate crimes against South Asians, Arabs, West Asians, and the Jewish population.
Residents protest modular housing in Marpol. The city council recently passed a bylaw allowing modular housing to be constructed quickly and without going into further public hearing. Now, as a result, the construction on a 78-unit housing site in Marpol began this week. Modular housing is meant to address the city's homelessness crisis. Some Marpol residents are protesting the housing site, saying that they don't have enough information about the coming tenants. Protesters expressed concern about tenants having past criminal history and reoffending. The modular housing unit will be located near Wilfrid Laurier Elementary School, which has concerned some parents. Those were this week's headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a short break and then hear some original reporting by UBC journalism student Annie Reuter on how Indigenous public art is gaining visibility in Vancouver. Stay tuned.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Hey there! This ad caught your attention. It also caught the attention of the coolest people from Squamish to Bellingham, music fans, students, and members of various cultural communities. If you want your ad to do the same, advertise with CITR and Discorder. If you've got a rad new ad or just something you want to share, whether in print, on air, or online, promote your wares, services, or events with us. Contact us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit citr.ca for rates, information, and packages. This is the end of our ad, and if you're still here, we must be doing something right.
We don't need to tell you.
And we're back. Thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Rahmatullah Sheikh. We just heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We'll now head towards a story published in the Thunderbird titled Indigenous Public Arts Gains Visibility in Vancouver. We have with us in the studio the journalist who wrote that piece, and that's Annie Reuter. Welcome, Annie.
Thanks, Rahmatullah.
Annie is going to read her story, which will be followed by a short interview with the News Collective member, Ryan Patrick Jones.
Indigenous public art gains visibility in Vancouver. Larissa Healy's aerosol mural, entitled Bringing Darkness into Light, dominates an alley in the downtown east side. It portrays healing from the fentanyl crisis. Healy is a graffiti artist who identifies as Anishinaabe. For her, creating art in the alley behind Vancouver's Army and Navy has been a dream for years. It changed a lot of people's lives, especially mine, Healy said of the 20-day painting process. That mural was completed late this summer. It is just one of more than two dozen works by Indigenous artists that have appeared in Vancouver since 2010. Within a seven-year span, the City of Vancouver has commissioned 13 significant permanent works and 20 temporary works by Indigenous artists. That means approximately one quarter of the city's recent public art program commissions are done by Indigenous artists. It's really picked up, said Healy, who's worked with the city's art program for more than 20 years. Healy's piece, Bringing Darkness into Light, was one of six commissions by Indigenous artists for the Canada 150 Plus Mural Program. The program drew in 47 applicants, 70% of who were applying to the city's public art commission for the first time. Healy's mural includes representations of Anishinaabe flowers, rainbows to represent two-spirited people, a traditional Squamish weave pattern, and Peter White, a traditional dancer who Healy describes as a good example for youth. We poured everything we had into it, said Healy. For many Indigenous people, however, celebrating Canada 150 was controversial. Some Indigenous groups believe celebrating Canada 150 negates the fact they lived on the land thousands of years prior to Confederation. Healy acknowledged that, but chose to participate anyway. She's quoted saying, there's a lot of issues around Canada's birthday. So my elders taught me we can either sit there and grump and gripe or we can do something about it. Young Indigenous artists in the city, like Suna Gale, are noticing the increase in Indigenous representation through public art, but would still like to see more of it. Seeing more Indigenous representation in public art is important to Galle, who says she feels the voice of the land is best expressed by the people who have interacted with the land and protected it for the longest. In the Vancouver area, that voice is of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. In the 2016 census, over 61,000 people in the Lower Mainland identified themselves as Aboriginal. James Harry, an artist of Squamish and European descent, works in sheet metal and carvings. He also would like to see more contemporary Indigenous art around the city to offset romanticized notion that Indigenous people and their art are stuck in the past. He says the airport does a great job of doing this, but would like to see more representation in the city and Lower Mainland. Harry's modern totem pole designs from sheet metal is featured at the Vancouver International Airport, which hosts the world's largest collection of Northwest Coast native art. Healy, Galle, and Harry all agreed that public art can modernize people's ideas of Indigenous culture and spark interest in learning about Indigenous art. Galle says media representations of Native culture still glorify the idea of the noble savage without really acknowledging modern Indigenous life and culture. In April 2016, Galle completed a non-city commissioned mural for St. Paul's Church in the downtown East Side. This mural depicts the interweaving of Catholicism and Northwest Coast Native symbols such as the wolf, raven, whale, and frog. Galle says the process of weaving Catholicism with Native populations was absolutely tragic, but the result is that a lot of Indigenous people have adopted Catholicism in some form. Her own family, who are Métis Chippewa from Saskatchewan, have done this. Since becoming a city of reconciliation in 2014, Vancouver has moved toward deeper engagement and consultation processes with its local First Nations. In addition to consultation on specific major projects, the city's Aboriginal Relations Manager, Ginger Gosnell-Myers, holds quarterly city meetings to discuss relevant upcoming projects that require analysis and input from the city's three nations. Eric Frederickson, Senior Public Art Planner at the City of Vancouver, says Indigenous artists are being consulted on temporary projects that extend out of Northeast False Creek planning. He acknowledges that False Creek is a significant Indigenous site, and this project is a way of connecting urban Aboriginal people living nearby in Strathcona, downtown Eastside, and Northeast False Creek areas. Three of the eight artists involved in the project planning are Indigenous. Frederickson also hopes a second mural call-out for Indigenous artists will happen in 2018. For young muralists like Galle, it could be the chance to contribute public art that has as strong an impact as Healy's.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story, Annie, and for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about your story. So what drew you to write about Indigenous art in Vancouver?
I'm new to Vancouver. I moved here from Toronto in September, and I noticed its presence basically right away coming in to the city. I personally really like art, and I wanted to learn more about it and recent initiatives that the city has undertaken.
So basically you kept your eyes open while you were getting used to your new city?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So and how did you get in touch with the artists? How did it go from idea to actual reporting?
The Eastside Culture Crawl was actually happening close to the time that I was doing research. So I found some artists through that and contacted them just through their information available online. A classmate of ours, her sister is actually featured in the piece, and I spoke with a city official who connected me to Larissa Healy.
All right. So is the increase in the number of public art pieces by Indigenous artists part of a concerted effort on behalf of the City of Vancouver?
It definitely sounds like it. It started in 2010 with the Olympics being in Vancouver, and the presence of Indigenous art has only increased since then. And it sounds like it's a very deliberate effort, especially because Vancouver is the world's first city of reconciliation, and that's a big part of it.
And so how can the Indigenous artists doing art in public spaces, how can this contribute to the reconciliation process?
I think the artists that I spoke to, they mentioned it and can probably better, frankly, explain it than I personally can. Mm-hmm. But I think having representation of the people who live here originally is really important, just kind of like a visual signifier of who the land belongs to. And that visual reminder, I think, can be a start, kind of.
So you mentioned Larissa Healy confronted a dilemma of sorts in deciding whether or not to participate in the Canada 150 mural program, given the controversy surrounding Canada's historical treatment of Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Can you speak about what eventually motivated her to go forward with it?
I think for her, this was a project just about, it was about community and also very fulfilling for her personally. So she explained that she's wanted to paint this for years. She's lived in Vancouver for years, and it's always been a dream of hers to paint that specific alley. And I think for her, it's important to have art reflected in the community where it serves the people who live there. So I think that it matched really well in All terms right. of the location and the people who live there. And it was a very collective process. I think she said there were about 12 people who actually helped paint the mural in addition to herself. So it drew in a lot of community members.
And so what did the mural mean to her in the end?
She described it as life-changing.
Oh, wow.
I think it was the coming together of community and a good example for youth through some of the figures on the wall. And yeah, I think really that whole coming together and community piece was important.
Well, that's great. It's a very important story. So thank you very much, Annie. And good luck in the future with your future reporting.
Thanks.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
UBC Africa Awareness Initiative is a student-run organization that advocates for a greater inclusion of Africa and African-related issues in UBC academia and social life. Some of our major events include Dioko, UBC's largest African dance party, Culture Night, a celebration of African culture and diversity, and Conference Week, where our goal is to foster more intelligent and intellectual dialogue about Africa on the UBC campus. With this in mind, we hope to contribute towards creating global citizens with a more informed perspective of the continent.
Am I wrong?
Man, they were nihilists, man.
Huh?
They kept saying they believed in nothing.
Nihilists. Me.
The Great Escape from Nihilism, Rediscovering Our Passion in Late Modernity by Dr. Gordon E. Karkner involves a journey out of the prison of contemporary nihilism and into a meaningful life trajectory. Rooted in the work of Canadian premier philosopher Charles Taylor, this book is a relevant read for students and faculty. You can find it at the UBC or Regent bookstores.
Who's the f***ing nihilist around here, you bunch of f***ing crybabies?
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 with discounts on Commercial Drive at
Audio Pile, High Life Records, Mintage, People's Co-op Bookstore, Stormcrow Tavern, The Rio Theater, JQ Clothing Limited, and Bone Rattle Music Limited.
Welcome back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Alamdi Alanian. Today, we've gone over headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland and heard a report on the increasing visibility of Indigenous public art commissions. Next, we have guest journalist Jonathan Ventura in the studio to read a story he reported on a pioneering Vancouver food bank that's creating safe space for the city's transgender community. Welcome to Democracy Watch, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. All right, we'll get into it. An East Vancouver food bank is helping low-income transgender people by providing access to healthy, fresh food. Sage Community Food Bank, gender-inclusive signs, and smiling volunteers welcome people into the trans-friendly environment, a visible contrast to the exclusion many trans people face. Ryan Hunter, co-founder of the Sage Community Food Bank, says Sage has always been a trans and gender variant space. He says they have always served minorities because those are the people who can't access a regular government food bank. The food bank is one of a growing number of services working to provide basic health and wellness for low-income trans people. These are services that many trans people are excluded from accessing due to safety, discrimination, and registration systems that don't accommodate for differences in gender. Other food banks in the Lower Mainland require people to have government identification in order to register and access services. Hunter says that trans folks often don't have proper ID or ID at all. Many trans people have trouble accessing government ID that reflects their identity because of name or gender changes. Proper ID can be especially challenging for those who don't identify as gender binary. This creates numerous problems for transgender people. Nikki Zawatsky, a diversity educator with multiple local health organizations, says anyone who doesn't fit in the box of male or female is going to experience a lot of exclusion, as well as harassment and violence. She thinks you shouldn't have to show identification to access basic life necessities like food. And it's not just food banks. Low-income trans people also have a hard time accessing employment opportunities, shelters, and health supports. Research on gender discrimination related to transgender people is underway in other parts of the country. Alex Abramich, a community LGBTQ plus homeless researcher, finds that trans youth are overrepresented in the homeless youth populations and are frequently discriminated against in shelters and youth-serving organizations. Discrimination can be sexual, verbal, physical, and can limit the access transgender people have to services. Jennifer Walwick, managing director of UBC's Stigma and Resilience Among Vulnerable Youth Center here at the UBC, says surveys clearly demonstrate that discrimination affects access to safe places and services, as well as emotional and physical health. Walwick's agency conducted a survey with Vancouver trans youth in 2016, which found that 1 in 3 older trans youth reported going hungry in the past year because they could not afford food. Approximately 70% of all youth surveyed also reported sexual harassment. Those who work in the trans community say that services work the most efficiently when trans people are involved. Brenna, a trans woman and activist, has worked with shelters and community leaders to develop trans-inclusive spaces. She says the best way to provide trans people with services is to have other people like them develop and facilitate programs. Brenna says Vancouver is on the forefront of that work. That's why, despite Vancouver's problems, she's excited to live in the city. Brenna and trans advocates believe more staff training, transgender representation on board of directors, and gender-inclusive signage will all help low-income and vulnerable trans people access more vital services. SAGE is just one initiative that adopts these inclusive practices, and there are others. TransCare BC is the first government organization of its kind in Canada that connects people to gender-affirming health and wellness support. It's a service made specifically for transgender people. Lucas Wilson, a health navigator for TransCare BC, says in order for trans folks access all sorts of services, inclusion has to be explicit. For the past 6 years, coordinators Hunter and Tanya Kuhn have been operating the SAGE Community Food Bank on donations and volunteers. Hunter believes it's just the beginning. They hope to acquire a new van and additional volunteers, which will help them serve more people. Hunter acknowledges that what they're doing is only a small step towards trans inclusion and equity in Vancouver. But after witnessing the community SAGE has built, Hunter feels hopeful.
All right. Thank you for sharing that with us, Jonathan. My name is Madeline Zeef, and I'm just going to ask you a few quick questions. How did you get involved with this program and this whole topic?
I guess the beauty of Facebook really connects people. So I'm new to the city, and I'm pretty involved in my community in Winnipeg. So I just started doing a little bit of Facebook research, and I found out about this really, really unique food bank here to Vancouver.
Cool. And why do people need government IDs to go to food banks, like just in general?
I guess they want you to register for the services. I think there is Ryan Hunter, the co-founder, explained to me that they need to be accountable because it is government funded. So they need to be able to track people in one way or another. He also mentioned the possibility of people doubling up, so people accessing multiple food banks. So there is some form of accountability for them, and administratively, I think that's the reason. Yeah. So it's a barrier that isn't specifically targeting community, transgender community, but I think it is reflective of a larger kind of systemic issue.
Mm-hmm. So does SAGE do anything to provide the government with that information for the people that are going to their community center?
Information that the SAGE Community Food Bank exists?
Yeah. Do they, tell the government about their, who's going to the food bank?
I don't think so. They're kind of an independent entity. Like, they are run completely on volunteers. There's zero budget. They're really stretched quite thin.
Mm-hmm.
I know Ryan works really, really hard to get things going and is kind of maxed out. So I think communication with the government is definitely low priority for them.
Okay. So you said that SAGE adopted these practices. What steps do you have to take? What steps do other food banks have to take in order to support trans people?
I think there is a push in kind of like wellness services for low-income trans people.
Mm-hmm.
Like shelters specifically are creating policies, signage, and consulting with the community to see how to best support and make sure that these spaces are safe. I think the SAGE Community Food Bank came from the trans community as well. So I think they initiated it and were able to kind of dictate how best to set it up for their own community. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that you said that really stood out to me was that 1 in 3 older trans youth reported going hungry in the past year. It's a pretty incredible statistic. Do you think that the inclusive policies implemented at SAGE Community Center will have a ripple effect with other food banks and community centers in the Vancouver area?
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's a tough one. I would like to say yes, but I think a lot of these organizations, even the government food banks, are run so thin that they're often just going week by week, month by month. Especially around times like now, Christmas, like mm-hmm. people are definitely in need, and as weather changes. So I don't know if it would. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd like to say yes. But.
So while writing this, obviously it's a pretty sad and heartbreaking topic. What was your biggest challenge while doing your research?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think the stories that were shared are really personal.
Mm-hmm.
So finding a balance between respecting personal stories, but also trying to connect with the audience who is going to be reading the story was a major challenge because it's such a complex issue. You know, I even just mentioned very briefly a few other barriers that the trans community faces, like accessing employment, accessing shelters, just very basic life necessities like that. The stories that I was told, being able to include that was, or being not able to include that was really challenging.
Yeah. Is there anything that you can tell us now? I know you just said that you couldn't include some things, but any stories or just like interesting facts that were kept out of the piece that you could share with us today?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the inception of the food bank is kind of a neat story that I didn't include. It started with a trans woman named Sage.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan and Tanya and Sage were all at a community dinner one Christmas. And Sage had brought this up. She said, you know, are there any places where trans people can go to access healthy food, where you know, it'll be a safe space, and all of them couldn't think of anywhere. So within 1 month, they started Sage Community Food Bank. And I think that really speaks to the power of community and being able to act when there is a problem. The sort of sad twist to that is that Sage did end her life shortly after that. So, but I think it's a beautiful story of hope as well. So.
Mm-hmm. For sure. All right, that is all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan. This is Democracy Watch. We're going to take another short break, and then we'll be back with more alternative current affairs coverage of Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Stay tuned.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
Tired of begging for rides from your friends?
Bobby, I don't have time to take you to the soda shop again this week.
Lugging those groceries on the bus got you in a sweat?
Man, oh man, these bags of salt sure are hefty.
Being on campus without a car ain't easy, so check out Zipcar and get wheels when you want them. Join now to get your membership for only $20 at zipcar.ca/UBC.
Having trouble finding affordable, fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan Building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power science world for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle. A tax-deductible receipt. And a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
And we're back. Thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Rehmatullah Sheikh. We just heard two news reports by UBC journalism students Annie Rota and Jonathan Ventura. Next, we'll be listening to a podcast produced as part of a multimedia report for the UBC Journalism School's online news publication, The Thunderbird. This podcast, created by journalist Dustin Patar, is part of a larger report on how BC students now make up 40% of seasonal wildfire fighters in southern BC. After listening to the report, we will have an interview with Dustin, and our News Collective member, Christina Song, will lead the interview.
This Labor Day weekend, Stefan Navaretti packed his black
2003 Jetta wagon hit the road and drove west. Though it's only an 8-hour drive from Nelson to Squamish, he was already feeling the impending change of pace. In just over 2 days, the university student would be thrust back into the classroom and away from the long summer days spent outdoors with friends, often near fire, and sometimes in a tent. Although it sounds like a scene right out of an outdoor gear commercial, it wasn't. It was hard work, and the transition back to school was challenging.
It's one of the most stressful times of the year, actually, for me.
That was Stefan Everetti. He, like many other students across the province, spends his summers as a wildfire firefighter.
The biggest culture shock I've ever had was going from firefighting to back to university. And it was just because, like, the lifestyle is so different, like literally polar opposites.
And this season, students like Navaretti accounted for up to an estimated 40% of the 1,000 or so seasonal personnel hired by the BC Wildfire Service. But they do it for a reason.
The money. It's my way to pay through school.
That was Elise Dubé, who has worked the last 3 seasons as an initial attack crew member when she's not studying history at Quest University in Squamish. There's also another major perk of spending summers with the Wildfire Service: time outdoors.
What really attracted me to it was that, like, it's guaranteed, like, good hard work outside where you get to do activities and things that you normally would never ever get to do. So things like flying around in helicopters to, like, fires, and then, like, hover exiting, like climbing out of a helicopter, like, while it's in a hover, and kind of getting sent all over the province to these fires, and working with, like, with a solid group of people. These are all the types of things that kind of attracted me to the job. And then, of course, the salary was also another factor. It was one way that I saw being able to help me pay for school. And also I saw it as, like, a good career, you know, if nothing ever does, like, come about once I am graduated from school, like, if no other career opportunity comes about after university, then, like, firefighting is kind of like a pretty stable career choice as well. So it's a little bit of a safety net for me, I guess.
That was Navaretti. Students say the benefits of wildfire firefighting don't stop with good pay or time outdoors. It's also an opportunity to make friends and gain a deeper sense of purpose. But this means that the end of a summer contract can be bittersweet. Not only are they leaving their firefighting friends, there's also the sentiment, especially after a season like this past one, that saw more than 1.2 million hectares burn, that they're leaving too soon.
It's nuts because there's still a fire, and you are watching fire happen as you're driving away, and it feels a little bit funny to be going back to school when there's so much work still to be done.
That was Keenan Novak, whose end-of-season drive back to school took him through the heavily burnt Caribou region. Despite those feelings, the need to return to school still prevails. Although school dictates their lives most of the year, as soon as they don the orange hard hat, red work shirt, and dark blue pants, they shed their student identity. Now in uniform, they're firefighters, key components of the Wildfire Service. This is perhaps most evident at the unit or crew level each spring, when non-student crew members, who typically begin in March, greet the incoming students at the end of April or start of May.
It's really exciting. First of all, we haven't seen them in a long time, and we've spent a lot of time as a smaller group, so again, that new faces showing up is pretty exciting. And there's just a feeling of having those 20 people back together again. It's like your whole team is there, and you're ready to go. It doesn't feel quite complete when not everyone is there.
That was Ellie Bay, a member of the Talqua Rangers, of which over a quarter were students this past record-setting season. But returning the following season is never a guarantee. For most seasonal wildfire firefighters, the spring transition back to physical work is a challenge.
To get your job back, you have to pass a fitness test.
That was Stefan Navaretti. And the training can be even harder for women.
So it's interesting. I'm a very short female, and I think for the fitness test specifically, that's being short in general is kind of a detrimental, or at least it's a harder test to do. And whereas, like, I have a lot of my guy firefighting friends, you know, if they don't work out all year, they can still do the fitness test. It might suck. It might be like shitty day for them, but they'll pass, you know, whereas like I don't have that luxury. So it's definitely because we have the exact same requirements and I carry the same weight as everybody else. I think that's a really good thing because I think women in this job, especially like they want more females to be involved in firefighting. So they'll accept some more females, maybe not more, but they'll accept females on an easier basis to boot camp, though we have the same requirements for the fitness test and boot camp, like for the interview and stuff, they're more likely to push you through. And so I think because of that, a lot of guys have this idea that we're getting it because we are women, not because we deserve it. So I think if the fitness requirements were different, that would just like further alienate guys and girls from this job. And I mean, of course, that doesn't, like, they're not going to expect on the fire line a girl who's like, if we're trying to put a fire out, they're not always going to expect me to, like, a 5'1" short girl to be carrying the 65-pound pump like all the way by myself for like 5-10K into like up a mountain, you know, like it's reasonable once you're in the job. And yeah, we still carry a lot, but it's, you know, you play on people's strengths.
That was Dubay again. But for students trapped at desks 2/3 of a year, it's even worse. Not only must they be writing their end of term papers and exams, they also need to be preparing themselves physically. For students going into their first season, the task of physical preparation is made slightly easier. It starts with a mandatory boot camp that teaches the recruits the ins and outs of wildfire firefighting. For veteran student firefighters, it's a little bit harder. They have to train on their own time, in a gym, or, much like in the fall transition, through outdoor activities like running, hiking, and climbing. Once the training hurdle is cleared, there's one last obstacle the students must face. The stresses of making the quick, often single weekend transition away from the classroom and into the field. Just like the fall transition, the spring transition brings excitement.
I'm usually just stoked to go back and get out there again and be spending all my time outdoors and seeing the coworkers that are my good friends.
That was Novak again. So while the province and the federal government figure out how to pay the $750 million bill from last season, Stefan Navaretti, Elise Dubay, and Keenan Novak already know how they're going to help pay for next year's tuition.
You just heard an exclusive audio report on BC student firefighters created by UBC journalism student Dustin Potar. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Dustin. My name is Christina. I'm going to ask you a few questions about the story.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
How did you come across this story?
It was hard to not see the headlines about like wildfires in BC over the summer, and it was hard to not see the smoke and just like kind of complain about it. And I thought to myself, it's like, what are those guys and girls doing now? The original idea for this was how do wildfire firefighters spend their time in the off season? And I was doing research and then I came across a stat where up to 40% of the wildfire firefighters are actually students on seasonal contracts. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. Let's try to track some down and talk to them. And, this is kind of what we got.
Great. Being in such a challenging position sounds like, it creates a greater sense of camaraderie. How do they feel about the uncertainty of going back the next year?
I think for the people that I talked to that aren't sure if they're going to go back, there's definitely a bit of sadness, actually. They're going to miss their friends. And then for the people that are going back, they're definitely looking forward to it. Because it is, I mean, if you ever spent like a lot of time in the outdoors and you're like with a small group of people, and sometimes they're on like the initial attack crews are like three people. So you're with the same three people all summer. It's like that bond is super tight. So like you're excited. They're all excited to go back and they're sad when they leave.
Yeah. Do these seasonal firefighters ever get injured or traumatized on the job?
The ones that I talked to haven't, no. They've all actually talked about how safe it is. One of the questions I asked that I didn't even get to put into the piece was what their parents thought about them wildfire firefighting. And I think that if I did something reckless or wanted to do something like that, my parents would be like, well, why? Like, you're like you have this image of like backdraft or something, or like crazy explosions and fires. And while there's busy times of the season, there's other parts of the season where they are just building trails, like there's no fires. So all from everything I've heard, like there's not much. It's just kind of business as usual.
So obviously they said that the money is a motivator for going into these jobs, but do you think there's anything else motivating them?
There's definitely other motivators, like well, they kind of talk about time outside. A lot of these people, a lot of these students that I talk to at least are up in Squamish, and they love the outdoors. So they love climbing, running, hiking, backpacking, cross-country skiing, like the gamut of outdoor activities. There's the fact that they do make friends, and of course there's money. But I think it's like, I think the outdoor aspect was something that was huge. Not a lot of them, like there's history majors, there's like psychology, like across the board. But it's like, it was the one unifying factor was the fact they love the outdoors and they wanted to like have some good hard work in the outdoors.
Did they find this year especially hard because of the scope of the fire?
They did, yeah. So this year, I mean, I talked to a few of them who, you know, worked up to like 17 days in a row, maybe with one day off. And those aren't like your 8-hour days. Those are like 16-hour days. Like, that's a long time. And you just get tired. One of the students I talked to said that the 8th day was always the hardest because you knew you were halfway done, or you're just over halfway done, and you still have almost halfway to go. And it's just like, that's a bit backbreaking when you're just on a fire line. And, you know, one of them told me a story where they would clear a line, they'd go overnight, the fire would have hopped the line, and then they have to make a new line. And then that happened again, and then it happened again. And so it's like, this summer was definitely challenging for them, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So do these seasonal firefighting jobs draw mostly students, or do you think there are other types of workers?
I think there's a lot of people, like, in the people that I've talked to that weren't students, there's a lot of other seasonal employees. So a lot of, like, ski guides, for example. So I think that, like, between students and then other seasonal employees that kind of flip-flop, I think that there's still going to be – I mean, there is obviously a contingent of full-time workers, but I think the, like, 40% of those seasonal, so almost half are students, and the rest, I'm guessing, are probably seasonal as well.
And we just heard from a female firefighter. Mm-hmm. Do you think there are special challenges for females going into this work?
I think there are, and I think at least highlighted it there. So they have the same requirements. They have to carry the same weight requirements. They have to pass the same training. She referenced that she's 5'1". That's crazy because like there are heavy things that you're carrying and they all have to carry the same weights. And obviously certain tools like pumps are heavier. So I think that there's that obstacle for sure. Just a physical element of, I mean, if I was 5'1", I would struggle a little bit more carrying, you know, a 65-pound pump than, you know, someone that's 6'2". So I think that it's mostly that physical element, I would say, based on the ones that I talked to.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming in today, Dustin, and that was a really great story.
Of course.
Up next, we've got an interview with Jim Mandeville of First On Site, a private restoration company that helps to clean up after wildfires. He's going to speak about his company's experience with wildfires in BC and how to prepare for the next year.
Speaking with me today, can you just start by telling me your name and position?
Yeah, my name is Jim Mandeville. I'm a senior project manager with First On Site Restoration.
All right, and can you tell me what a little bit about First On Site?
Absolutely. We're Canada's largest independent restoration company, and we specialize in restoring people's homes and businesses after they've experienced some sort of incident, be that a fire, a flood, or wind damage, or I think in the case we're speaking about today with ambient smoke and wildfire damage.
All right. And so First On Site has done some work restoring southern BC communities affected by the 2017 wildfires. Was First On Site hired by the BC provincial government or the federal government?
We were primarily working for large business institutions and some government entities. The specifics of that I can't really get into. What we were doing was helping to manage the air quality in a lot of facilities that the first responders were using, as well as a lot of private and essential businesses to the community, so that the employees are safe at work and that these essential businesses can continue to operate through periods of very heavy smoke.
All right. And so what kind of work did you do in BC specifically?
Specifically in BC, we installed air purification equipment in several hundred locations. We also did some cleaning once the smoke had passed in some communities. Again, the soot residue that's left by an urban interface fire, which in some cases in some communities we were faced with, it's got a lot of stuff in it that's not good for you, and it requires a very thorough and professional level of cleaning to make sure that the occupants are safe down the road.
All right. And so how has your company seen natural disasters like wildfires change in recent years?
Certainly they're increasing, and the pace of them is increasing. We've also seen that the public has a lot more sensitivities towards their health. Whereas, you know, years ago, people would have some soot in their home or in their business and not really think too much of it, as it's just something that happens every year. And, you know, as science progresses and society's overall focus on health progresses, we're discovering that it really was kind of a big deal, and we probably should have done something about it.
So are you seeing an increase in demand for your services?
Yeah, absolutely we are, especially when it comes to things like air quality. Again, where people used to sort of just tough it out, that's not really happening anymore. So we're definitely seeing a much higher demand for that. As well, I think a lot of public education happened with the fires in Alberta last year, and again this year with the, you know, the amount of news coverage they received. So people are just a lot more sensitive to it than perhaps they once were.
All right. And today on our show, we featured a story by it's published by the UBC School of Journalism's online news publication called the Thunderbird.ca. It stated that 40% of BC's seasonal wildfires firefighters were students this past season. How has First Onsite noticed how government orchestrated response efforts to wildfires in BC are diversifying to deal with the larger, the more massive fires?
Well, they were certainly forced to diversify. The logistical challenges involved this year in the season were unprecedented, with fires spread out over in excess of 1,000 kilometers. So a lot of things that had been done in the past and the way they were done in the past just couldn't have been effective. So we definitely saw a lot more firefighters than we're used to seeing. We saw a lot of with the military in Williams Lake assisting in a logistical capacity as well. It was just a lot of fire spread out over a lot of places, and that takes a lot of firefighters, and that takes a lot of logistical support for all those firefighters. So it's ever increasing and ever diversifying, both in BC and across the country.
All right. And so what can people do to better prepare for wildfires coming next year?
It's always important that you have all of your documents together and ready to go. And this goes for everybody across the country. You need to have your ID and your passport and your bank cards and all that stuff together in one place, so you're not rushing around looking for it. It's also important to have cash. If you're fleeing one of these events, oftentimes the only way to get gasoline is to pay in cash because the telecommunication networks are down. And it's also important to have 3 days worth of supplies in your house, you know, food and water for your whole family. In the event that your road is closed or your community is sealed off, you can be self-sufficient for at least the first few days until first responders can get to you.
All right. And is there any way that people can reduce the damage to property?
Absolutely there is. It really speaks to building resilient communities. And when you do a renovation or you're building a new home in an area where there is a risk of wildfire, it's really important to consider the materials that you use on the outside of the building, and making sure that you're not using flammable materials like asphalt shingles or wooden siding or wooden shingles. You know, after these fires and the fires in Alberta, the houses that survived in heavily damaged neighborhoods were those that had non-combustible finishes on the outside.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Join us again next time, Thursday at 5 p.m. for Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage on Vancouver and Lower Mainland. I'm Christina Song. Good night, and stay tuned for more CITR programming.